My name is Tom. If we haven't met, I'm one of the pastors here at Spark. And I've been here about, 10 years or so, and I've just loved the opportunity to worship with all of you. For those of you who are new or missed the last 3 weeks, Pastor Danielle shared in week one that the author of the book of James is actually technically called Jacob, not James. Surprising, right? And this goes back to the Hebrew roots, the Jewish roots of the text. And so since we are Spark, we decided here to use the name Jacob throughout the book, and I'm covering Jacob chapter 4 today. So let's get started. This little book, or should I say letter, near the end of the Bible almost didn't make the cut. Martin Luther said this letter had way too little Jesus in it, because Jesus only gets mentioned a couple of times. And things like faith and work seems to contradict what Paul says about these same topics, but that's for another day. As we've seen over the past few weeks, this is a deeply practical book about deeply important issues that are facing the church, things like being careful with our words and not showing favoritism, and how to endure trials and trouble in wise ways. Now today, we're going to be looking at one of the central challenges that faced Jacob in sort of his life as a pastor, and that was the challenge of leading a church at a moment of immense division within the church. If you remember in the book of Acts, which is the book that really tells the story of the early church, it is the same Jacob, the brother of Jesus, who in Acts 15 is the key leader of the Jerusalem Council, which was a really important council for the early church. And at that council, it was Jacob who ultimately issued a letter that Gentiles, that's predominantly me and you, that Gentiles or non-Jewish people should be welcomed into the church with open arms, right? So Jacob, he was important. One scholar said it really wasn't Peter that was the first pope. It was Jacob. He was the one that Peter and Paul came to for direction in this idea that Gentiles are now welcomed into the church. And this was also a big deal in the cultural moment. See, for the first time, a community of people was not just the religion of a single tribe of Jewish people, but instead, the door was opening wide, and this new kind of community was coming into being that had never been dreamed up before. A community where people from all over the world, from different backgrounds, different cultures, different races, and different languages. When you read about the Pentecost in Acts 2, they were speaking in multiple languages because they are from everywhere. They are Elamites, they are Medes, they are Persians. It probably looked a lot like the Bay Area. And like any new community, they experienced change with all sorts of hard questions. Questions like, should Gentiles be circumcised now if they are a part of the Jewish religion? I always say the church in its early years, it was the fastest growing movement in the history of the world, that it would have been different if that question had been answered differently. Should Gentiles now be commanded to follow the Torah, having to meet the 613 commandments of God in the same way that the Jewish people were? And were Jews now okay to eat with unclean Gentiles and to eat unclean food? You can read all about this in Acts 10 and 11. And in the midst of these sort of big life questions, big theological questions that were often divisive and contentious questions, Jacob will become the one who is tasked with answering this question. What does it look like to move forward in the world together? And that question, I would argue, is as important today as it was 2,000 years ago. We talk about this all the time, and we all know it, but the world around us is increasingly polarized, right? It's increasingly divided. And that's not just politically, that's in the church too. It's divided about ethical and moral questions, derived about a whole host of things. Debates around human sexuality, rights for immigrants, women in ministry, climate change, to what we believe the Bible is or how we should read it. And more recently, people are quarreling over whether we should be people with empathy. Imagine that. A sociologist at the University of Illinois at Chicago named Michael Emerson, who's been studying the American church for 30 years now, said this: "There's a level of conflict today that I've never seen. The key difference now is that disagreements are over entire worldviews, not just specific issues. It's over politics. It's over race. It's over how we are to be in the world and even what religion and faith are for." And what's so baffling to me, and maybe to you too, is that regardless of where we are on these things, on the spectrum of things, we say we follow the same Jesus confessionally. We read the same Bible ostensibly. In traditions, we share some basic creeds. We baptize, but it's usually the same, where we do it in the name of the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And yet, despite so much that we share and that we value, here's the sad reality of the church and the society around us. It's more divided. In Jacob 4, verses 1 to 2, Jacob writes, "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You desire, but you do not have, so you kill. You covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight." A wonderful New Testament scholar named Scott McKnight says that when Jacob writes, "so you kill," there's no reason to think that he's actually speaking metaphorically. Because in the early church, there were leaders, teachers, who in theological debates or for any other number of reasons, when they disagreed with someone on the other side, they would kill him. That sounds crazy, right? But if you think about it, dueling with pistols was a real thing in America if you disrespected or disagreed with somebody. That's how Hamilton died. And Christians led the Crusades, killing lots of people. I think so often today we just take that for granted, this polarization. We're on this side or we're on that side, right? We're on the good side or we're on the bad side. What we see in Jacob 4 is Jacob challenging these church leaders and us today to not think in terms of conservatives or progressives, Democrats or Republicans, Americans or you name the foreign country, but instead in terms of a person, a person. You'll notice that Jacob opens chapter 4 by asking this question: those conflicts and disputes among you, where do they come from? Now, it's interesting. If we were to stop just at that first question and honestly ask this question of ourselves, I'm sure we would have all sorts of answers about why such conflict exists right now among us as the church, or even more in a global context as we look at things going wrong around us. I venture to guess many of our answers would have to do with how someone is right or someone is wrong. Even as I've asked this question of myself, my answer is how someone outside of me, apart from me, did something right or wrong to influence why we are where we are in this moment. I often hear in my own thoughts, my own instincts, it's the world's problem. It's the culture's problem. It's the progressives or the right's fault. It's the president's fault. It's the former president's fault. If you turned on the news this week, it was Israel's fault. It's Iran's fault. Now, if Jacob just stops at that first question, our response about what it means to be this revolutionary community called church is really easy. Because we are the good people, right? They are the bad people. We separate ourselves from the bad people. We tend to live in our sort of sectarian little bubble, cut off from the world. And we see evil always outside of us. But here's the challenge. Rabbi Sacks called this tendency pathological dualism, which is a mentality that divides the world up between those who are impeachably good and those who are irredeemably bad. Anybody in here impeachably good? Anybody in here irredeemably bad? Thankfully, what we see is that Jacob doesn't stop at that first question of where the conflicts come from. Instead, he asks a second question. He says, do these conflicts and disputes not come from your cravings, which are at war within you? Now, when Jacob asks this question, he's sort of answering his first question with a question, and the second question is the answer to the first question. And he's saying that these conflicts come because we are internally at war. It's this reality that, as Eugene Peterson once said, the moment I began exercising my will, my desire, these cravings, I put the fox in charge of the chicken coop, and it gives me the most trouble. Anybody like that? William Ernest Henley's poem, Invictus, said, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. And because of that, I'm headed for the rocks. Or as Gerald May once put it, I have a lot of willfulness, but not much willingness. Willfulness, but not willingness. Dallas Willard, the great late theologian, said it like this, contempt and anger toward others is nothing but a manifestation of the will to have my own way. Families, communities, and sovereign nations become embroiled in deadly conflicts that would be immediately resolvable except for the relentless desire to want to have my own way. Now, it's important to remember the context Jacob is speaking to when he makes this same point long before Willard or Henley or Peterson or May. Jacob is speaking presumably to leaders, teachers within the faith community. You can go back to Jacob 3, verse 1 and see why this is the case. You heard it from Pastor O'Meara last week. And so when he talks of cravings, he's specifically calling out religious leaders for their desire to have influence, to have power, to have partisan power, even leaders who want their own way. Jacob is saying, just focus for a moment, not on everything that is outside of you, but on yourself. What's going on inside of you? What's going on inside of me? He doesn't say which side is right. He doesn't say which side is wrong. Though that's not to say there isn't a right and wrong. Let me talk about that for a moment. I think it's important because some people think Christians should not be political, that we should not take a side. But I don't agree with that. Let me explain. President Trump sent out a text several weeks ago saying a whole civilization will die tonight. He was talking about the nation and the people of Iran. This text, it was vulgar and horrific. And many Democrats, Republicans, and independents condemned the text, rightfully so. And some people said the Pope should stay in his lane and be quiet. But not Pope Leo. He responded. He spoke up. He said, Jesus told us, blessed are the peacemakers, but woe to those who manipulate religion in the very name of God for their own military, economic, or political gain, dragging that which is sacred into darkness and filth. And importantly, he was asked, why did he get involved in this quarrel with President Trump? This is a key question. And he said, I have no fear of neither the Trump administration nor speaking out loudly about the message of the gospel. And that's what I'm called to do, and that's what the church is called to do. I do believe that the message of the gospel, blessed are the peacemakers, is a message that the world needs to hear today. Pope Leo said that speaking out loudly about the message of the gospel was his calling, and what the church is called to do. Friends, we are the church. It is our calling to speak out loudly about the message of the gospel. He also emphasized in his last statement that we were to be peacemakers, because that is what the world needs to hear today. But that word peacemaker often gets misunderstood. It does not mean passive. It does not mean silent. It does not mean pretending harm is normal. Peacemaking is what happens when you see suffering and refuse to look away. And it's what happens when you care about dignity more than power. Peacemakers stand with the grieving. They listen to the wounded. They ask hard questions about systems that cause harm. They care about accountability because they care about life. So should the Pope stay in his lane and be quiet? I don't think so. Let's get something straight. The gospel is political, not partisan, but political. Jesus preached good news to the poor. He flipped tables in the temple. He confronted the empire. He uplifted the oppressed and called out hypocrisy in high places. That's a political truth that's not timid or neutral. But hear this. While we can disagree and have strong opinions, we still need to be civil to each other. Now, let me be clear. Churches should never tell you who or how to vote. Pastors shouldn't hand out ballots from the pulpit. But if your faith never speaks to injustice, if your Jesus never challenges your politics, then maybe you're not worshiping Jesus. Maybe you're worshiping your ideology with a cross tape on it, meaning core loyalty is still to the ideology, not to Jesus. So no, I don't think we should stay in our lane, because following Jesus means crossing lanes, breaking barriers, flipping systems that harm the vulnerable. And because the gospel doesn't have lanes, it has roads that lead to freedom, justice, and mercy, and truth. Silence isn't faithfulness, neutrality isn't holiness, and comfort has never been the goal of the gospel. In this call to look inward before we look outward, to be peacemakers rather than power seekers, it didn't begin with Pope Leo. It goes all the way back to Jacob and the one Jacob himself followed. It's fascinating. Jacob's words in this text, flow directly from how Jesus navigated the world himself. In John 8, Jesus says to the Jewish leaders, wait, don't throw that stone. Let the one who is without sin be the first to throw the stone. And they all put their stones down, meaning look at your own heart first. He says in Matthew 7, Jesus, in the greatest sermon ever preached, he will say, just take a moment and notice the log in your own eye before you see that little sliver in someone else's. Jesus continually offered this invitation because he knew our human tendency is to utterly miss our own stuff and to utterly and completely live sort of this comfortable life in spaces of self-deception. I know this is true of me. If you look at the prophets in the Old Testament, the prophets kind of had a Jacob-like tone to them. They sound crazy sometimes with things that are taking place. You ever notice how the prophets are kind of like that grouchy uncle you had growing up? And the reason why is because Israel often was doing something that was not God's will. They weren't living in God's way and by God's design. And so the prophets, they would speak these bold words and they would speak them to a people. They would say, change your ways, repent, return to God. But every prophet who ever prophesied in Israel, do you know what they always did first? They confessed their own stuff. They talked about how they were wrapped up as part of it, how it was just Israel's problem, but it was the human problem. Every prophet except one did this. Do you know the one exception who couldn't quite get there? Any guesses? Jonah. One prophet. He can't see that the problem is not the Ninevites getting God's grace, but the problem is his own will. If you remember at the end of the book of Jonah, God shows mercy and compassion towards 120,000 people who were considered Israel's enemy. And Jonah, he's angry that God just won't kill them, won't just get rid of them, right? Be done with them. Jonah can't see the problem. It's not the Ninevites getting grace, but the problem in this moment, it's actually his own will, his desire, the battle within him. The challenge here is to not look around, but to look within. And Jonah can't quite get there. In fact, at the end of the book, you got to feel for this guy. He's sitting under that tree, and you know what he says? I'd rather be dead than watch God save 120,000 of my enemies. Jacob writes in verse 3, when you ask, you do not receive, because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures. Now, what Jacob is indicating here is that something has become really misaligned. Misaligned for his faith community on the level of the deep down level of our desire, of our will in particular. Jacob says these leaders are asking for and praying for things that do not align with God's kingdom, rather than God's expansive vision for what the world is supposed to look like. Think Jonah's prayer, right? Just kill him, God. Jacob is basically saying this way of praying is asking God to give us what we all want. You know, the vending machine God. Just give us what we want. Sounds like a spoiled four-year-old, right? And saying, God, just do it the way we would do it is a form, actually, he says, of befriending the world and becoming an enemy to God. And so Jacob, he indicates the core of this problem about desire, that it's really relational. He says, we have befriended the wrong desires, our will, and it's not aligned with what God's will is in the world. And in that verse, you see the word friendship. It meant a lot more than it means today. With our thousands of Facebook and Instagram friends and this sort of casual idea we have about friendship. The notion of friendship was sort of rooted in what Aristotle wrote about friendship. That apart from being a casual relationship, there was a certain deep fidelity to friendship. That you were invested in one another's life. And actually, in friendship, you are impacting another's desire and their will. This is all a part of being a friend. And so here, Jacob employs that word friend to those teachers as a way of asking them, who have you aligned yourself with? Who or what is shaping your heart and your desires like a friend can, who is loyal and devoted to you? And he writes in a prophetic tone that's similar to Hosea, or Isaiah, or Jeremiah, or Ezekiel, and he said, you adulterous people. Now, he doesn't mean they're literally committing adultery. He means that they've been unfaithful to God, whom they've covenanted to, right? In other words, Jacob wants them to consider with this friendship idea, who is our desire being shaped by? Is my desire being shaped more by the news that I watch than the good news of Jesus? Am I being more influenced by the pressure of social media influencers who are literally paid to claim some part of my will, and even less importantly, some part of my wallet? Jacob has a lot to say about humility in chapter 4. Instead of killing our enemies because we spent time with Jesus, we're challenged to love our enemies. Instead of dividing the world up in these tiny categories, us and them, good and bad, we see that those patterns of good and bad, they run right through the middle of every human heart. And if you read Jacob slowly, you'll notice the whole passage is sort of hinges on these words that are found in verse 6, which goes like this. But he gives us more grace. Not just grace, but more grace. Now remember contextually, Jacob is saying that these words to the pastors, the teachers who are prone to kill other people in the name of God or for political gain. We would probably call these people religious zealots or religious terrorists, right? And Jacob is saying these aren't people who are telling white lies. These are some of the worst of the worst of the worst. And you know what? God's grace is there all the same. Jacob, who's not known for his theology of grace, says it's not just grace, it's all the more grace. It's lavish grace for you and me and them. Jacob is saying that when grace floods into our lives, what it ultimately does is it gives us better things to desire, but it also gives us more power to desire them. It's grace that continues to outrun and outlast the thousands of ways of our stories have become misaligned with God's own. It's a grace that forgives to the point that my deepest human needs for identity and belonging and love are met now in Jesus and his cross and his resurrection and his ascension. Far from being some sort of one-time transaction, this grace is transformational for us. We don't look for power or influence or getting our way like these teachers in Jacob 4 did. But instead, because of God's grace, we seek to do the next faithful and loving thing that's right in front of us. And now we come to our last verse, verse 7, where it says, "Submit yourselves then to God." This word submit, I think it is often misunderstood. A lot of our interpretations make it so it's misunderstood. I think it means to place yourself willingly under the guidance, direction, or authority of another, not out of fear or coercion, but out of trust, purpose, or shared commitment. And with Jesus, it's about being reoriented toward love and belonging. Jesus technically never told people to become Christians. He told them to become disciples. And that word disciple means apprentice. And it's funny because I'm sure many of us may have learned that word apprentice from a TV show about power and winning. But Jesus' version looks nothing like that TV show because his apprentices don't compete for status. They learn how to love like he did, which means Jesus wasn't trying to get people to agree with him. He was inviting people to follow him, to watch how he lived, how he treated people, how he handled power, how he responded to suffering, and how he loved. And then he invites us to do the same exact thing. That's what an apprentice does. You don't just believe in the teacher. You become like them, which means this isn't just about what you believe. It's about who you are becoming. Not do I believe in the right stuff about Jesus, but am I becoming more and more like Jesus every day? Because you can call yourself a Christian and still not be a disciple. But you can't be a disciple without actually following Jesus. And following Jesus means you try to be like him, and inevitably you will fail. But with Jesus, you receive grace. You learn to love, so you get up and you still try again. So when we call something Christian, we should probably ask, does this look like Jesus? Because last I checked, Jesus didn't celebrate an entire civilization collapsing. He wept over cities. He didn't say this is a great moment in history. He said, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. So we have to decide, who are we following? Because if you are following someone or something else other than Jesus, well, those don't lead to the same place. Friends, Jesus didn't call us to win. He called us to love. And in just a moment, we're going to do something that apprentices of Jesus have been doing for 2,000 years. We're going to gather around this table because communion isn't just a ritual, it's a reminder that grace always shows up first, that before we do anything, before we get it right, before we stop losing the war within us, Jesus gives himself. That's what this table is. It's grace made visible. For in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, "Drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." All are welcome at the table.